I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Tammy Dean is our engineer. The old mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. Today's show is about possibilities. In grim times where we face ecological and human catastrophes, people are rising up and offering models for revolutionary change. Leading off the hour, the mole's Bill Resnick talks to Joanna Bazua, research associate at the Democracy Collaborative, about how public ownership of electric utilities can be used as a strategy for energy democracy, and how the California wildfires have increased the potential for communities to take over corporate giants like PG&E to create a more equitable and sustainable future. Then I speak with Mercy Strongheart of the Wimby Tenants Union and Margot Black of Portland Tenants United about today's rally and press conference at Wimbledon Square and Gardens, where energized and organized tenants are demanding a rent abatement for ongoing livability issues. Fran Michel comments on the crisis of climate change, our dire circumstances, and positive responses happening locally and internationally in the courts and on the ground to save some of the livable world. At the end of the hour, Jan Hocken interviews writer and activist Emily Johnston about the trial in Minnesota last month, where she and two other climate activists enlisted the necessity defense in a landmark jury trial. In October of 2016, Johnston was one of the five valve turners who together instigated a shutdown of all of the tar sands bitumen pipelines coming into the United States from Canada. Now, here is Bill Resnick with Joanna Bazua.
Hi, Johanna Bazua. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for having me.
Johanna Bozua is a research associate, the chief energy analyst at the Democracy Collaborative. It advocates and models radical democracy at the local level, well known for creating worker-owned and controlled cooperatives in many communities. Their underlying principle, that is the underlying principle of the Democracy Collaborative, is that true democracy must start in daily life when ordinary people of our extraordinary species, when they meaningfully participate in making the decisions that shape our lives. Johanna's research and activism is in local energy democracy. Her writing demonstrates that the only way to avert climate catastrophe is for communities to take over the electricity systems, to nationalize the corporate investor-owned utilities, then to build out very quickly clean, renewable energy production, and also to work to organize the community toward greatly reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. We'll get to that later. First, though, Johanna, tell us about what's happening in California today that makes local democratically run energy possible and necessary.
Sure. But the California wildfires that are raging through California are just barely contained now. Putting clear relief that California's investor-owned utility, electric and gas, PG&E, is not suited for the job of managing our energy systems. They were at least in part culpable for starting the Camp fires that have been the deadliest California wildfires to date because of the electrical power associated with their infrastructure. And this is not an isolated incident. They've been to have started 17 fires in 2017 alone. And the California Public Utilities Commission is starting to invest PG&E for their safety and have surfaced this idea of breaking up this large utility. But we don't need to just break it up. We need to bring it into public ownership. It's because we have these full guarantees of rates of return, but PG&E has been prioritized building a grid and investing in the safety and maintenance for these communities that are now, you know, Butte County has something around 12,000 residents that are displaced right now. But PG&E is focused on boosting kind of their corporate profits and paying its executives millions. So instead of reinvesting, bundling it into kind of this growth shareholder model. But there's the opportunity here by bringing it into partnership that we could shift and do what California wants to being a climate leader by both creating more resilient grids and shifting toward more local energy and shifting away from a fossil fuel-based extractive economy and moving more sustainable energy models that are based on what the communities want and need, which is not how PG&E right now.
California, unlike most states, but there are some others, that they have programs called community choice aggregation, but it's basically a community choice program that people can set up, that the people in cities of any public entity, actually, a city, a county, a region, can vote to, in fact, take over the electricity system and to become a public utility. Tell us about that, and particularly about Alameda County.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the community choice aggregation programs, there are about 19 in California right now, and it's projected to serve something like, I think, 2.5 million customers in California soon. And this just shows that Californians are hungry for public ownership of energy and taking the energy transition into their own hands for rapid mobilization toward community ownership of energy. I think that one of the greatest examples we have of this is the great organizing work that the Local Clean Energy Alliance has done in the Bay Area. They now have what's called East Bay Community Energy, which gathered the energy needs and procurement needs of the surrounding cities and now have found ways to really localize the investment for renewable energy so that they can create a more resilient energy structures and that they can actually use this opportunity for energy procurement to invest in their communities and help build local jobs and local capacities in energy. And so I think that community choice aggregation really shows that with the opportunity for community agency, we can shift towards a more renewable future that's also based on equity. And I think that that's something the Local Clean Energy Alliance has been able to do, is an imbue democratization and equity into how their community choice aggregation runs right now through having things like a board, an advisory committee of local community members that's telling the board what the community is actually asking for. And I think that we can reflect a lot of that if we are to take PG&E into public ownership and take some of the learnings that we have from community choice aggregation already in place and move it up in scale in California.
Give us a little more detail about what it means to have community energy. What are the sources? For example, rooftop solar, people investing their sums and their equity into producing electricity and then feeding it into the system and being paid a fair price for that. That's one of them. There are so many ways of reducing emissions and creating clean energy, but go through some of the things that are being done.
So I think you mentioned a good one, which is rooftop solar. This is really distributed energy where people are investing in making their own energy. I think that there's also opportunities for what is called community solar, in which people can pool together their funds. If they don't have a rooftop, that's great for solar. The amount they can produce on the top of their house doesn't cover all that they will need. They can invest in community solar, which is larger scale investments and installations that then they will receive the benefits of. And I think that another kind of piece here is we can get to the utility scale of renewable energy in community ownership through community choice aggregation, when the community has decision-making power in deciding where it's sited, how it's sited, who is seeing the benefits, who's actually installing it. Is it a local installer? Is it a organization, maybe a worker cooperative that's doing this and is providing workforce development opportunities? So I think that we can imbue democracy into both the highly distributed rooftop solar, but it can go all the way in these publicly owned structures to kind of larger scale energy procurement as well.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Johanna Bazua, who is a research analyst and does a lot of writing, some very interesting stuff recently. You can look her up. Her last name is, spell us your last name, B-O-Z-U-W-A. Johanna,
yep, that's right.
Johanna with a J. She's with the Democracy Collaborative, and then you can find links to her stuff. Johanna, let's get back to the enormous advantages of community energy in terms of just reliability and also speed of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The days of big grids seem to be huge trillion-dollar grids. They're ended.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things as we are seeing more wildfires hit California is we are going to need to see investments in more localized renewable energy, particularly for this reason of resiliency. When you have climate-related events happening more often, you need to be able to take pieces of energy on and off the grid in more effective manners. Things like microgrids are going to help in building out some of that capacity. You can connect this to emergency shelters. You could have community solar that's on the top of, let's say, a local school that can act as an emergency shelter in these types of situations and provide that really necessary power in these moments of need. And that is something that I think could be facilitated and done if we were to take the grid particularly out of for-profit hands, as it is right now with PG&E, and move beyond just the energy procurement as something that is community-owned through community choice aggregation, move to a full system perspective so that we're not investing in large-scale transmission unless we really need it. And so thinking through how we make those decisions and who is at the table making those decisions. Is it for-profit corporations that want to make a return on investment because they get cash for capital infrastructure? Or do we want it to be something that's decided by communities when it is actually needed? And I think that that's what bringing PG&E into public ownership could help do, is build out more of those capacities for renewable energy that is locally and community owned, and make sure that we aren't having large scale transmission build outs unless we really need them.
Germany is very much like Oregon. They don't get that much sun, and yet Germany and many other places that are not as efficient in some kind of engineering sense as creating energy. But it turns out if energy is created at the point of use, even on a cloudy day, it doesn't have to be transmitted thousands of miles in which electrons are lost, and then, and it doesn't have to be transmitted through trillion-dollar grids that have to be highly securitized and invulnerable to the weather, which none of them are now, so they'd have to be all rebuilt. The grid, it seems to me, is now, climate change has made it financially unfeasible, but the power companies and the banks, they want to maintain their current system. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the big issues with investor-owned utilities. They are allowed to make it sometimes, it's usually around 12% return on investment, kind of no matter what. And this means that they want to funnel that into their shareholders and not actually into investing in the grid.
They're regulated by the public utility commissions, and they're given the power to raise prices to make sure that they can pay their fairly high interest rates to the banks and rich investors.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that by moving closer to point of source, that that is going to be a really big opportunity that investor-owned utilities, because of their incumbency and the way that they receive money, is not going to be of interest to them. And so I think that by shifting towards public ownership, the dynamics really change in who is making those decisions. And so we can work to localize energy to the amount that is possible and like increase the efficiency of that transmission. We will have to invest in better transmission lines, and we might need to do some build outs if we're going to have this large scale shift towards renewable energy, but we have to ensure that we're making these decisions for the right reasons and we're investing in a safe and reliable grid. One of the issues we're having with PG&E right now is that they have old transmission lines that they aren't taking care of and aren't ensuring are reliable and resilient and aren't putting people at risk, which is what we're seeing right now with these wildfires.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Joanna Bazua, who is a research analyst, writes a lot on the great virtues of local community energy, democratically run. You know, there's a lot of people, of course, would say, oh, the state would run it, a bunch of bureaucrats and lazy bureaucrats who won't really work in the public interest. And really what we need is the dynamism of the private sector. One thing about California, and one reason why community energy is so important, is in fact they have a lot of public utilities. The public utilities in Los Angeles, I believe, and Sacramento. In California, they see the relative dynamism of the Los Angeles public utility that's been selling electricity to people who live in their area much cheaper than Southern California Edison can dream of selling it. That's why many counties are moving towards public energy, because it's so much better managed. And the Sacramento public utility, SMUD, is extremely innovative and agile and also sells electricity a lot cheaper and is much more active in permitting feed-in tariffs. At least that's how I understand it.
Bill, I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. I completely agree. There's this concept that, I mean, you have public ownership, it enables, yeah, as you say, like so much bureaucracy, and it won't be for the community. But I don't think that is true. And I think you point to some really great examples at SMUD in LA that actually are dynamic and are innovative in a way that the investor-owned utilities aren't, because they aren't focused on corporate growth. They're focused on the ultimate shareholders, are the community members and their customers, which creates a very different dynamic. And I think that also we need to think about what efficiency means in these contexts. It's not about what your return on investment looks like per se, or how fast you can make your money back, but actually, how can you use the investments in renewable energy to build out, for instance, really good jobs and eliminate things like energy poverty through this? So even if it's more expensive, or let's say less efficient in the ways that kind of the capitalist terms of today, we can rethink what efficiency means, and efficiency should really be how it's serving community members. But public ownership across the board has really been shown, at least in the United States, to be cheaper than investor-owned utility service areas. If you look at American Public Power Association's research on this, they show that it is consistently cheaper in publicly owned service areas.
And, in fact, it helps in the development of, like, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is the great example of, even though they're environmentally not so good because they dammed up a lot of rivers, that was in the 1930s, They basically electrified the South.
Right.
The private utilities would never touch it. It was only the Tennessee Valley Authority under the New Deal that brought electricity to not just the hollows of Kentucky and West Virginia and the rest of the South, but it brought it to all the big cities of the South that were also not appropriately powered because big capital just didn't want to do it. You don't make enough money on it.
Yeah, I think that's another really important point here, too. During the New Deal, essentially there was market failure, right? So the investor-owned utilities said, hell no, we're not going into these rural areas. We just can't make it. There's not the right bang for our buck. But there was this desperate need for rural electrification. And as you said, by investing both in rural electric cooperatives and TVA, though it is wrought with issues, there are problems of historical racism there. And those are things that we need to work on. I think that, again, we see that there's a current market failure that's happening with investor-owned utilities in which they aren't taking climate change seriously. And so that's why we do need state intervention, and we need to take this into public ownership to deal with that market failure. And so I think that we can also, at the same time as we're moving into more public ownership, redefine how public ownership operates so that it actually imbues equity and is thinking about how can we rapidly mobilize towards equitable renewable energy that serves the community and democratizes how decisions are made. So we're iterating upon the public ownership that we had that was initiated through the New Deal.
Johanna Bozua, thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah, Bill, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure to talk and think through these really important questions with you and how we move forward. So really appreciate all that you do on the Old Mole, and look forward to listening in again sometime soon.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be lost are oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Lost mother. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are lies. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand that?
That was Marvin Gaye, Mercy, Mercy Me, The Ecology, from his 1971 classic album, What's Going On? Before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Johanna Bozua talking about the potential for community energy and democracy. And we now turn to another source of community energy and democracy. With us in the studio are Mercy Strongheart, who's with the Wimby Tenants Union in Portland, and Margot Black of Portland Tenants United. Thanks, you two, for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so Mercy, do you want to tell us what's happening later today at Wimbledon Square and Gardens?
Sure. So today at 1 p.m. at Wimbledon Square and Gardens near Southeast 20th and Holgate, Wimby Tenants Union will be holding a press conference, and we're going to be speaking about conditions at the apartment complex. We'll be giving a tour to press to show them some of what's going on there. And we're going to be speaking up about what we would like the management company there to do in terms of increasing livability for us.
So what have been some of the issues facing residents at Wimby, and what led to the formation of the tenants union?
Where do we start?
Yeah. Well, so I moved in a year ago, and a few months after I moved in, I started experiencing water shutoffs, and after about 20 or so water shutoffs over the course of 4 months.
All day water shutoffs.
Yeah, they ranged anywhere from 3 hours to 24 hours, but generally toward the longer side of that. And I'm a single mom, so multiple times I would come home at the end of the day. I was not always told that water shutoffs would be happening, and I would find no water for cooking dinner, bathing, flushing the toilet. And that, for me, was the acute issue at the moment. And I've since learned through speaking with a bunch of my neighbors that this property management company, Prime Management, has a long history of negligence with this complex. I'm guessing with others, but for sure with this. And so what happened was somebody in the office sent out an email alerting everybody of a water shutoff, and they forgot to blind copy everybody. So accidentally, over 200 of us got each other's email addresses. And that's when we began speaking to each other and sharing stories and realizing that the problems are way greater than the water shutoffs and have been going on for multiple years. So we've been organizing since.
Now, the owners of this complex, Prime Group, LLC, they own some of the largest apartments in Portland and also have tons of other complexes in other cities. And they don't have a very good record of serving their tenants, even though they're taking rent money from people.
Market rent money. I mean, that's the thing, that the conditions are poorer there than I have seen in any of my volunteer tenant organizing over the last 3 years. It looks very nice and shiny from the outside. And I don't mean to say that, you know, the tenants at Wimbledon are living in the worst apartments in the city of Portland. There are certainly, you know, very poor conditions experienced throughout Portland and especially east of 82nd. But for the amount of rent the community is paying and for what is, you know, advertised, I have just never seen such a level of blatant disregard and negligence. I mean, the stories I've heard there they've been incredible. I mean, I there isn't a tenant that I've talked to who doesn't have a long list of really egregious things. I mean, we have stories of water pipes crumbling in people's hands, somebody waking up in the morning to find their shower ceiling in their bathtub, and it was a week before maintenance even came to look at it. Multiple stories of maintenance coming in and not actually fixing it, and it's not necessarily because maintenance is incompetent, but because the fixes are a lot more systemic than they're needed, and they're just not addressed. And, you know, there's very good evidence for this with their recent loss of the $20 million lawsuit for the rotted walkways. And one of the reasons that settlement was so high was because they knew about the problem. They were told, they were even cited by the city, and they didn't do anything about it until somebody had a really serious injury. And then even in light of that, you know, loss earlier this spring, they haven't changed any of their business practices. And for 600 units, it's just mind-boggling how above reproach they believe they are. I mean, they're not even giving 90-day notices on rent increases. Like, that's easy. And they're not even doing that. They just don't care what the laws are because no one's enforcing them.
So then what are the options for tenants, you know, with that flagrant violation of laws and unhealthy, horrible conditions?
Well, when an apartment complex or when your unit has livability, habitability issues, that's one of the places where tenants have more options, especially in terms of legal options and lawyers who will actually represent them. But it's still really hard to enter the legal process and to even know what to do. And that's why, I mean, we have certainly, you know, you can request that your landlord repair things. You can go through the process of taking legal action if they don't. You know, that process is arduous, or we can organize. And I mean, ultimately, when the tenants came together, I was just invited there, I think, to their second meeting to hear what they were doing. They were already coming together. They were really clear that they want to, you know what their legal options are, but that they really wanted to make sure that you don't have to sue every single time you need to get things done. Like, that maybe all together saying, hey, this is a problem and we're not okay with this. We deserve better. And of course, using the strength in numbers solidarity model, that if they all speak with one voice, maybe we can get management to pay attention and to make it a better place to live more sustainably without a lawsuit.
So, Mercy, what are the immediate goals then of the Wimby Tenants Group?
Well, we are starting with the first two issues that we're addressing are the two that are most impacting the most amount of tenants most strongly at the moment. And those are the water shutoffs that continue to happen, and also the walkway repair, which, while we haven't been told as much, I'm guessing is a result of the loss of that $20 million lawsuit. So Prime Management has begun to repair the walkways around the complex, and the way that they're going about the construction, I don't know if they could do it any differently, but it's certainly making the units that are in front of the construction completely uninhabitable, and yet people continue to live there. Constant jackhammering 6 days a week outside of their front doors, the walkways torn up outside of their front doors, the siding being pulled off of their units. It's Margo and I just walked around that area the other day, and we were actually afraid of falling and hurting ourselves. It's so dangerous down there.
There's exposed wiring. There's literally the path we're walking on, it says hard hat area, and this is how tenants are getting in and out of their apartments. And of course, repairs need to be made. But when the repairs, you know, significantly inhibit the livability of a unit, tenants were given a letter saying that they can't enter or exit their apartment during business hours for up to 2 weeks. And of course, then the dates were different than what they were told, and it lasted longer. They can't get in or out of their apartment during business hours for 2 weeks. There are people with disabilities. There are people with pets. There are people with, you know, babies who stay at home with their babies all day. And Wimbledon didn't even offer alternative housing or any rent abatement or anything. Like, fine if these repairs need to happen, but don't the tenants shouldn't be paying full rent for this. You know, they've been paying their water bill every month, which, despite, you know, over 30 days of water outages, has gone up. And Wimbledon hasn't made any accommodations or offers. And in fact, what were some of the things the managers said during the water debacle?
Well, many of us were refused water when we went to the office for water, despite being told they would have water for us. I was refused water. I came back the next day, which was day two of one of the shutoffs. I brought my daughter with me, my little daughter, and was told I could have 1 gallon after being without water for 2 days. Neighbors have been told by staff, well, I've gotten it together and bought a house. So really, and people have been yelled at for going in to complain. I mean, it's very hostile.
And this is all along while tenants are paying pretty astronomical water bills each month.
Yes. To give you an idea, I have a one-bedroom apartment. I pay over $1,200 a month in rent. Well, I guess my water is rolled into that. My water right now is climbing. It's over $80 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. And, you know, I'm not even there every day of the week.
Well, there's no laundry in that apartment. There's all, you know, she also has to go to a laundromat. So $80 in water in a one bedroom for not even laundry.
Well, let's give listeners the details about today's rally and press conference.
Well, so the rally, there's actually going to be a rally next Saturday. So today will be a press conference at 1 p.m. and that will be at the Wimbledon complex outside the leasing office. And then next Saturday will be a rally from 1 to 3 p.m. The exact location is unsure, but right now, to just say the Wimbledon apartment complex is good enough, I think.
Okay. And then just in terms of a broader strategy, I know Portland Tenants United has been working to mobilize tenants throughout Portland, but are there some long-term goals for equitable housing in Portland and in Oregon that tenants groups would like to see happen?
Well, certainly on a policy level, you know, long-term goals, or rather immediate goals, especially with our new legislative session, are rent control and an end to no-cause evictions. But by organizing these tenants and exposing these issues, and also letting you know this group of tenants know that they're not alone, they deserve better, together they have power. This is what PTU has really been working on all year. And what we would really like to see is that when tenants form a union, and especially when they have, you know, some internal structure to that, this WIMBY Tenants Union has a committee. Mercy's the co-chair of the committee, and, you know, a lot of kind of good process, you know, with the number of tenants involved and outreach. You know, we want to see that the management will recognize that union and come to the table. And rather than kind of force these, you know, dramatic theatrics every time. And I wasn't with the tenants when they let the management know that they had formed a union, but maybe Mercy can say more, but
tried to let them know.
Tried to. Doors were slammed in their faces. And that was after, you know, and the letter even, you know, basically implied they wanted to work together. So ultimately, we'd like to see the right to collectively bargain our leases. We'd like tenants to organize and demand that they be recognized as a block and that management comes to the table to make it better for the entire community rather than relying on them to do, you know, piecemeal enforcement and insertion. Because, you know, Wimbledon absolutely is relying on tenants not knowing about their rights or not, you know, not having the wherewithal or caring enough to assert them. And that helps by being across the street from Reed. They have a healthy, not to say anything about Reed students, but they just have a healthy group of students moving in and out who are going to come no matter what the last tenants experienced. And so they know they don't have to do anything until now. Now they're going to know that they have to do something.
So it's through tenant power then that
tenant
we create
power, yes.
That justice in housing. Well, Mercy and Margo, thanks so much for joining us. How can people find out more about the Tenants Union at Wimby and also Portland Tenants United?
The best way to find out more about Wimby Tenants Union at this point is to send us an email at wimbytu@gmail.com, wimbytu@gmail.com, and we will do our best to answer you same day. We're very communicative with people. We'd love to share our information.
And for PTU, probably the best way is our Facebook page or our webpage, www.pdxtu.org. We try to keep folks pretty updated on goings on through there.
Thanks, Mercy Stronghart and Margo.
Oh, and join the Tenants Union.
Thank you so much.
The kind of thing someone takes for granted, not me, oh no. You see, it's a thing of beauty. It may not look like much to you, but that's okay, it does not have to. I see you stare sometimes glare. The thing you don't know is there's love in here. A house is more than what you fill it with. You see, to me, it's the basic human right for dignity and safety. That's home to me. Oh, 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 that's home to me. Oh, oh, oh. Stop, rethink, question the things you see. Know everything on TV in real life has deeper meaning, eh? Is not a luxury, it's more than four walls and a foundation.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Monday Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard from Jewel, who teamed up with Rethink Housing to raise awareness for the benefits of public housing. And before that, we were talking with Margo Black, Portland Tenants United, and Mercy Stronghart with the Wimby Tenants Union. Next, Fran Michelle with more on the links between equality and sustainability in her well-read Red.
Today's Old Mole is about the challenges of climate and ensuring a just transition to a survivable world, and about doing what we can to make the world survivable. Scientific American recently reported on a study suggesting that visualizing specific aspects of climate change could change behavior. People asked to imagine how flooding or droughts would affect particular people or places were more likely to engage in environmentally friendly actions. The more fully we consider climate change, the more we're moved to act on it. Plenty of recent events are making it easier to imagine the extension of effects that have already begun. Droughts contribute to wildfires, warming oceans intensify storms. People are dying in fires and hurricanes, heat waves and floods, and people are dying in the aftermaths of these more frequent and more intense disasters because they lack access to electricity and clean water. And when roads soften and melt in extreme heat, as happened earlier this year in Australia, emergency vehicles cannot reach those needing rescue. Yet, as we know, many people, in the U.S. at least, doubt or deny the reality of human-caused climate change. In the trial of climate activists in Bagley, Minnesota, almost all of the potential jurors expressed these denials. And even those of us who do know what's happening may fail to appreciate the urgency of our situation. A couple of weeks ago, at a political meeting, an old comrade said something about the need to act on climate change in 30 or 40 years. Several other people present jumped in to say, we need to act in the next 12 years. That is, after all, the way that much of the mainstream media conveyed the gist of the recent special report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. But the problem of climate change is even more urgent than the 12-year figure suggests. an array of resources, including last month's IPCC report and last week's release of the National Climate Assessment, provide more and more information about what is happening and how very fast. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, recently said that we have a year and a half to avoid runaway climate change, which is a more accurate reading of the IPCC report. As the National Climate Assessment confirms, the only real surprises have been that some changes have outpaced earlier projections. In its most extreme versions, runaway climate change could mean massive extinctions of most of life on Earth, including our own species. Already, the World Wildlife Fund reports that 60% of the world's vertebrate wildlife has been wiped out since 1970, mostly because of habitat loss. But even the calculation that we have 18 months to change direction does not take into account the effects of the Trump administration's regulatory rollbacks or Jair Bolsonaro's plans to sell off and cut down the Brazilian rainforest. And it may be worse than that, given the cautiousness of the report and the uncertainties about tipping points and feedback cycles. For instance, there's the problem of the disappearance of Arctic summer sea ice. As the Arctic warms, sea ice melts and exposes dark ocean waters that reflect sunlight less efficiently. The decreased reflectivity causes a reinforcement of Arctic warming. And there's permafrost melting. As global temperatures rise, melting permafrost releases carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere and creates a feedback for even more warming. There's even a feedback loop wherein rising carbon dioxide leads to thicker plant leaves that absorb much less carbon. Meanwhile, crops are less productive and less nutritious. Water has already hit crisis points in Sao Paulo and Cape Town. And climate change is heightening conflicts and prompting migration. The Breakthrough Center for Climate Restoration has criticized the reticence and caution of the IPCC. In the breakthrough analysis, human-induced climate change is an existential risk to human civilization, an adverse outcome that will either annihilate intelligent life or permanently and drastically curtail its potential, unless carbon emissions are rapidly reduced. But the possibility of human extinction and the certainty of millions of deaths from climate change hardly suggests it's time to give up trying. In the analogy offered by Kathy Dello, Associate Director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, when you're riding a bus and you miss your stop, you don't stay on the bus forever. You get off at the next possible stop. We need to take action as soon as possible. There isn't any point at which we simply give up and accept the accelerating disaster, riding the bus to the terminal or off a cliff. Some comrades on social media have objected to what they see as left catastrophism, emphasizing that the planet itself is not dying. Eric Holthaus, writing in Grist, says that getting people to understand the scope of this staggering problem requires a balancing act. Too much doom and you promote hopelessness. Too rosy and you risk glossing over the urgency of the situation. But even the worst-case scenarios hardly justify throwing up our hands and going all in on evil. Given the tendency of climate change to most negatively affect those already vulnerable, we have all the more reason to continue to work for social justice, healthcare, housing, education, empowerment at work, and all the changes we need, whether or not. Moreover, positive responses are happening on national and local levels, in the courts and on the ground. Ireland, France, Germany, and Bulgaria have banned fracking. Norway has become the first nation to ban deforestation, and Ireland plans to divest entirely from fossil fuel investments. Fossil fuel divestment campaigns continue to pressure businesses and institutions to pull financing away from these destructive industries. And Portland voters passed the Clean Energy Fund measure. A number of U.S. cities are suing Exxon and other major polluters for having purposefully misled the public about the effects of climate change in order to keep profits high. Bernie Sanders is hosting a town hall on December 3rd to be broadcast on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter as part of pressing for a Green New Deal. Our Children's Trust awaits a possible court date for the Giuliani case, previously discussed on The Old Mole. Valve-turner Ken Ward is hoping to win a new trial on appeal so as to be able to present a necessity defense in court. The People's Dossier on 1.5 centigrade contains the stories of communities fighting against fossil fuel projects and for a fast, just transition to 100% renewable energy. It outlines how climate change is currently impacting them and grounds their fight in the latest climate science. And more direct action is also happening. The group Extinction Rebellion in the UK has been shutting down parts of London to demand government action and a citizens' assembly to oversee changes as part of creating a democracy fit for purpose. In the U.S. and around the world, people are putting their bodies on the line, sitting on trees, locking down equipment, blocking pipelines, and protecting water at Bayou Bridge, Louisiana, at the Mountain View Pipeline in West Virginia, at the proposed new Line 3 in Minnesota. As Eddie Barkan recently put it in The Nation magazine, this moment calls on us all to become organizers, to be heroes for our communities and future generations, to talk to our less political friends, neighbors, classmates, and co-workers, and to enlist them. We cannot save the world we knew, but we can save some of the livable world. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
Nature's waiting.
Thank you, Fran Michel, for your well-read read. And here is Jan Hocken speaking with Emily Johnston.
Welcome to KABU, Emily Johnston.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, in 2016, you were part of a coordinated action across four states to shut down oil pipelines, and you have come to be known as the Valve Turners. Last month, you and two of the other valve turners went on trial in Bagley, Minnesota, enlisting the necessity defense. And the acquittal that resulted from that trial has been confusing to many, and I'd like us to talk about how you see the outcome, especially after a month of reflection. But first, let's talk about the action itself and the aim behind it, and I think the plan of coordinating the action across four states.
Sure. So we decided, you know, when we decided that we needed to do something sort of dramatic in order to highlight the dangers of climate change and try to get the system, which is so clearly stuck, a little bit unstuck, we decided that we really had to target either tar sands or coal, because those are the worst in terms of emissions. And tar sands in the pipelines, you know, seemed like a very logical target. And then we also realized that there were only five of them coming into the United States, five pipelines of tar sands bitumen. There's a little bit more that's refined.
These toxic oils that are produced in northern Alberta.
Exactly. Yeah, and they basically clear cut and destroy the equivalent of a Scotland sized piece of the boreal forest in Canada, ripping it up in order to get at the mucky tar sands beneath, which they have to use quite a lot of energy to extract it because it is so mucky. They have to make it flow. They have to use lots of chemicals, lots of hot water to make it flow into pipelines. And so, yeah, so we decided that, you know, with a small number of people, we could instigate the shutdown of all of those pipelines. And that's what we decided to do. So, and that's what we did on October 11th, 2016, in four states. There were two pipelines right next to one another in Minnesota, where I was with Annette Lasting and Ben Joldersma, our support person. And then there was the Keystone pipeline in North Dakota, the Keystone One, and the then Spectra pipeline in Montana, and the Kinder Morgan pipeline in Washington State.
Part of what was compelling about this action was it did highlight the whole coordinated system of oil pipelines throughout North America. I think often there's a news focus, a kind of riveting interest in the Dakota Access Pipeline or the Keystone XL pipeline, and here and there you see action around one of the pipeline sites, but you really drew onto the stage, media stage, this network through, and the call for coordinated action against a whole system of oil pipelines.
Sure, yeah. One thing that was highlighted immediately by Reuters was that we actually caused a shutdown of 15%, the equivalent of 15% of U.S. daily oil use, which was very striking to us. We had not realized that would be the case. And so, you know, if five people basically can shut down that much of our oil use for the day, it just sort of highlights the fact that these companies cannot operate without our consent. You know, they have literally millions of miles of pipeline, across the country. They have, of course, the oil trains, they have ships and tankers and all kinds of things. So, and they have to come through our communities, through our farmland, everything else. And so, you know, if people really decide that it's unacceptable for us to keep barreling towards, climate apocalypse in the way that we're doing now, you know, we do actually have a lot of power because we can stop these things from moving easily. We can stop them from moving at all for periods of time. And in doing so, you know, we can really highlight the problem and the fact that we need a systemic solution.
The action was both symbolic and prefigurative in the sense of engaging in an interruption of a process that
right.
calls for massive interruption and
exactly.
blocking the path of these very aggressive pipeline companies. Now, the actions are sometimes presented on the news as a kind of spontaneous outrage, but in pursuing the necessity defense and planning this action, there's quite a bit to consider, and some of the reasoning behind it was at the center of the trial in Bagley, Minnesota last month. Can you speak to the use of the necessity defense and that this as a relatively new strategy in the climate movement?
Yeah, well, so I wouldn't call it I don't think it's new so much. I mean, a lot of people have been trying this over a period of years, and it's certainly not new in the sense of, you know, people tried this successfully, you know, with regard to like demonstrations at nuclear installations, etc. So this is the kind of case where people try to raise necessity defense. And we specifically did this action in part because it would allow us, you know, because it happened in four states, it would allow us four chances to get the necessity defense. And only in Minnesota were we, in fact, granted it. You have to be allowed to pursue that defense.
At a jury trial.
Yeah, and of course, what's normally the case is the only question is, did you break the law, you know? And because we live-streamed it and because we were very open about exactly what we'd done and how we'd done it, that, you know, we had to persuade the judge that whether or not we broke the law, but why we broke the law. And, you know, there was a whole separate hearing in August, a year and a half ago, as to persuade the judge, in essence, that we had a reasonable belief that what we did was necessary. And you have to prove several different things. You have to prove that the harm you were trying to prevent was greater than the harm that was caused by your breaking the law. You had to prove that the harm was imminent, that you had no other available options that might work other than breaking the law, and that you had reason to believe that what you did might be effective at helping to solve the harm. So that's a pretty high bar. You know, one of the classic examples of the necessity defense is if you're walking by a burning building and you hear a baby crying from inside, you're completely and totally allowed to break and enter. You can break down the door and try and get the baby out because the baby dying is a greater harm than the fact if you're breaking and entering. And so essentially what we were saying is, all of the world's babies are in this burning building, and we have to break down the door now. Like, we have tried everything else. People have been trying for decades to approach this problem, you know, using legal methods, and we're not getting anywhere. And we know we are flat running out of time. And, you know, the UN climate chief said something in September about we have a year and a half to be on a path of radical, you know, emissions reductions. It was phrased somewhat differently with the most recent IPCC report. But the fact is, like, we need to be changing our ways now in really deep, systematic, and as the IPCC also said, historically unprecedented transformation is what we need right now. And, you know, that was very apparent when we did the action 2 years ago as well. So
The acquittal was celebrated by some and announced as a victory, but you were not able to present a full necessity defense and at trial. Can you describe the ruling of the judge, the outcome of the trial, and your thoughts about it now?
Yeah, so two different things happened, and they tend to get conflated. But so, you know, the judge granted us the necessity defense, and the judge had from last summer, a year and a half ago, you know, a full list of our necessity defense witnesses, knew exactly the kind of case we intended to present, and all systems were go. So when I arrived in Minnesota, you know, a couple weeks before the trial, because there was a pretrial hearing too, you know, we all thought that we had, we knew exactly what the trial was going to look like, and it was going to be so, so important. I, you know, I thought it was going to be perhaps the most important thing I would ever do with my life is that week of trial. And that's not so much because of what we would get to say, but because our expert witnesses were people like, you know, James Hansen, the former head of, you know, NASA's Goddard Space Lab. And so, you know, we were also bringing people who would talk quite explicitly about why civil disobedience is helpful, you know, when it has been helpful in the past, and how it helps to shift sort of deep-rooted problems, and people who would talk about, like, the reasons we had no other alternatives because, you know, our system is currently so sort of bought and paid for by the fossil fuel industry. And anyway, so we had extremely persuasive witnesses lined up to speak for us, people with a lot of authority who could speak very eloquently to why this kind of action is necessary now. And then 4 days before the trial, the judge all of a sudden, out of nowhere, said that we could not have any necessity defense witnesses. We could not have anybody speaking about climate change, anybody speaking about why there are no alternatives, anybody speaking about how civil disobedience can be effective. And this was completely surreal. Nobody saw this coming in any way, shape, or form. Even the prosecutor had only asked that we be allowed fewer witnesses because they were afraid of the cumulative effect of those expert witnesses. So, you know, this was, you know, it was gobsmacking, basically. We didn't know what to do about it. We thought it was, you know, impossible and it was going to shift. And we were just trying to figure out how we could salvage having some of our expert witnesses be able to speak to these things. Because, you know, I'm a poet from Seattle. My friend Annette is a retired tribal lawyer. Why on earth would a jury in Northwest Minnesota believe us about the urgency of climate change? You know, the former head of NASA, that's a different story altogether, right? And so, you know, and we also had the guy who wrote the pipeline safety manual who was going to say that we were preventing harm. And so, you know, but again, without those witnesses to speak for us, our case was completely gutted. So we were devastated and just trying to figure out, you know, how we could possibly salvage some portion of it. And then, you know, the jury was seated on Monday. The prosecution.
So, Emily, we're going to close in shortly, but I would like to have you on the Old Mole again as your work continues. And just to conclude, you were acquitted, but that you were not able to present the necessity defense and the experts you had scheduled. So you had the rug pulled out from under you, and there's many speculations on why that happened, but the work continues and has achieved even more urgency. And this action, which was what's described as a high legal risk action, is also requires other kinds of actions in support of it. And thank you for your good work and for being here on the show today, Emily Johnston. And we all honor you and all of the other activists engaged in civil disobedience.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Thanks, Jan and Emily Johnston. And thanks to our earlier contributors, Mercy Stronghart and Margot Black, Bill Resnick and Joanna Bozua. And from all our guests and Moles, we learned that this is a moment of both great challenges and opportunities for resistance. All these KABU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KABU.fm and click on Donate.